Accession number 4800, rule number 1.
This is real one, Squadron Leader Manfield, Air Chief Marshal Barraclough interviewing. Squadron Leader, as you know, the War Museum is collecting and recording the interwar experiences and history of the Royal Air Force. But of course your career went on from before the war till afterwards, and you became air crew and served as navigator in Bomber Command, and you were commissioned, and then went on to 1959 in various activities and commanding your own units. So what we're going to talk about is, of course, only one third of your career, but I just think it'd be nice to note this at the introduction of the recording, that it was a long and successful career, and we're just going to talk now about the first bit from 1929, starting as an aircraft hand up to just the beginning of the war in Hong Kong, I think, as a flight sergeant. What I'd like us to do now would be if you would tell me about your entry into the service, what moved you to do it, what it was like, what your experiences and impressions were as you were trained and moved around and gradually given more and more responsibility.
Well, I was a young lad of 17 living right out in the wilds of the Sussex-Surrey borders, where my father was a chauffeur on a large estate. I had noticed in the summer of 1928, when I was 17, the usual manoeuvres had been going on. The army had been around, and one thing and the other was going on. And the RAF used to fly over of an evening very often with aircraft, which I subsequently found out were Vickers Virginias, going from Manston, I believe, to Flowerdown or somewhere along there. And I used to see these going over, and I thought, well, I think I would rather like to be a part of that. The army didn't greatly appeal to me, nor did the navy, although my forebears were seagoing people. It seemed to me that the RAF would be the life which I would enjoy. So I obtained a reference from my father's employer, and I wrote away to the Air Ministry, and a little while later I received a notification asking me if I would report to Wider House in Whitehall one morning at about 10 o'clock. So a friend took me into the railway station on a very decrepit old motorcycle. I had a very small case with my shaving materials and some soap in, and after a while we arrived at Gwide House, and I was received there and was given a medical and an examination, intelligence examination I suppose one would call it, and
hadn't gone through these examinations,
I suppose, satisfactorily. 2 in the afternoon, with some, I suppose, there must have been about 10 or 12 of us were gathered up together by a sergeant who had a red sash across his shoulder, and we were taken to an underground station and made our way eventually to West Drayton. When we got there, we were ushered into a cookhouse and given a meal, and then directed to a barrack room where we stayed for the rest of the day. Early next morning, we were put together again and taken into a room where, if my memory serves me correctly, there were a couple of officers. And we were attested, took the oath, and were then bundled into a 10-ton, and I beg your pardon, into a 5-ton lorry, and went to Uxbridge, the then recruits training depot. Somewhat the same sort of procedure went on there for the rest of that day. And I suppose we spent most of the afternoon looking out of the barrack room window at a lot of people who were marching up and down the square, carrying out different evolutions. Some were doing rifle drill, some were saluting, some were just marching. Next day, we were taken down to a shed at the back of the barrack blocks, and there we were issued with our uniforms. In those days, the uniform we were issued with was breeches and puttees, a tunic with a dog collar, overcoat, three shirts, three pairs of socks, and housewife, nightwalker, spoon, etc. These were handed to us over the counter as we went along, and we were then given our numbers, and we stamped our numbers on every article that it was possible to stamp it on.
Anything about numbers in your recollection of your service life as significant?
Yes. I found, particularly later on, after I left Uxbridge, although even at Uxbridge, one's first three figures, although we had in those days a six-figure number, and although the last three were the ones which were usually referred to, an NCO would ask you, what are the last three figures of your number, lad? Or you called out your last three figures when you were paid. But as far as the service was concerned, I think the first three were of far more significance, because they decided to some extent your status and standing. I was your order in the pecking list. For if you had a number, mine for example was 510340, if a person whose first three figures was 509. This indicated, firstly, that he had joined before me, therefore he had that much more service. Therefore he was a far superior being than I. But to revert to the issue of clothing, you were there, the tailor, camp tailor, who fitted you and altered such garments as required alterations to such garments as were necessary. And you then waited for these to come back. In the meantime, for a couple of days, you were issued with a pair of horse left-hand pair of boots, and these you can use to carry out things. This would consist of cleaning up the cookhouse, washing tins in the tin room, washing floors in the School of Hygiene or School of Dentistry, and generally being employed on cleaning up duties.
Had you chosen a trade at this stage?
I had not chosen a trade because in the first week or so, trades were not mentioned. I had enlisted as an aircraft hand, known colloquially to the instructors as and tradesmen that one came across as an IBA, ignorant bloody aircraft hand, was the translation. But after the first week, when I had been squadded, by saying squadded, I mean that when you had been in a squad, you had been placed in a squad, which meant that you were now onto the square, the conventional training. I was told, we were informed, that certain trades were available. The ones that I was informed of were MT driver, policeman, or store. Such time as I had training. When we started the training, it was just basic drills, marching, saluting, rifle drill, and in those days, of course, bayonets as well. And we had to go to school as well. We had some education. I can't honestly remember what it was. No, a bit far back, but I know we went to school. We also had training in aircraft handling. And this consisted of reporting with your squad to the MT yard at Uxbridge. And undercover there was an old Sopwith Stripe with a rotary engine from the First World War. And the fuselage, the bare fuselage of a Bristol fighter. One did one's dummy run in prop rigging, which was what handling can be consist of.
It was engines. That was engine starting.
Yes, engine starting. Knowing when, being taught when to remove chocks, the drill for removing chocks. One did one's dummy runs on the Sopwith Stripe, which we approached, and I think there were three in the team, one with his hand on the prop. One is in the opposite direction, holding his hand, and then another one attached to him. And on the given word, having carried this out satisfactorily, the big day came when you had to start the Bristol fighter. Physically to start. There was a fitter sitting, and he gave the necessary instructions, and one started the engine by hand swinging, and then you and One of the major problems as a recruit I found was the fact that we wore breeches and puttees. The breeches, when originally issued, were extremely baggy, and one found that people took different measures to make them look a little more shapely by placing bachelor buttons at the top and a small piece of wire in the wing to make them stand out a little so they looked a little more stylish. One had to be quite careful about this because although the authorities didn't like it, they were not too hard, but people who went to the extremes would find that they would have to buy themselves a new pair of breeches. The other problem was the puttees. The original ones issued were cut straight, and it made for considerable difficulties to get them on neatly without pockets. Latterly, these were improved. In fact, whilst I was at Uxbridge, we were issued with a pair of fox's puttees, which were cut on the spiral, and therefore these fitted much more neatly around the calf. But one had to be extremely careful that one didn't bind them too tightly, because marching or walking in them could become extremely painful, and in fact could cause you to stop and have to loosen the things. They had to fit in accordance with regulations, of course, two fingers below the knee, and the point in line with the seam of at the side of the breeches. However, this all passed, one got used to it, and after 2 months one left Uxbridge as a fully qualified AC2 IBA. I was posted from Uxbridge to Eastchurch on the Isle of Sheppey as an under-training storekeeper. For the first time here I came in contact with real aircraft, because the armament and gunnery schools on the station, as were number 33 Squadron with Horsley aircraft. And this was a great thrill to me, to see actual airmen, people who flew aircraft. Although my task at the time, in the month or 6 weeks that I was there, was in the stores amending what is known as the AP-1086. This was a schedule of all the bits and pieces in the Royal Air Force other than aircraft or MT spares. These amendment lists came out regularly, and of course the effectiveness of the volume depended on the fact that it was amended up to date. And apart from duties, amending the 1086, that was the sum total of my undertraining as a storekeeper. But from Eastchurch, I went to RAF Kidbrook on the edge of Blackheath to the storekeeper school. And there I did a 6 weeks course, at the end of which I passed out as an AC1 storekeeper. Even whilst one was on the course, had to carry out firefighting duties. This meant that you were on standby in case there was a fire on the unit. And instead of letting you sit around whilst you're on this duty, you were detailed for fatigues. And this fatigue invariably meant going to the cookhouse and peeling potatoes. These we peeled, I must confess, after the first half hour, largely by dicing them. We didn't peel them, we just cut a cut the sides off and the ends, and that was the potato peeled. But when you're faced with 300 or 400 weight of potatoes after the first few minutes, you get rather fed up with the sight of them.
Well, Squadron, that was really the completion of the first phase of your training in the Royal Air Force, and you were reclassified or promoted to AC-1, and then I think went on to your first, as it were, fully trained posting, wasn't that so?
That is so, and I was posted to the RAF base at Fort Grange, Gosport, which was a Fleet Air Arm base. This was in one of the old Napoleonic forts at Gosport, and was the base for the Fleet Air Arm when they came ashore. Here, the station was run on naval discipline, although it was commanded by an RAF officer. I was sent to work in the station stores in the engine spares section, and life became quite routine there. And after a matter of 6 months living in the caponias, the sheds which ran off the central moat of the fort, I then was posted overseas. In fact, I had volunteered to serve on HMS Glorious, which was commissioned around about that period of time. But instead of being posted to the Glorious, I was posted to Egypt.
Well, I suppose you must have seen something of the Royal Navy and of the aircraft carriers. How did they regard this new young service?
Well, it seemed that they managed to get along pretty well. The only time that we really saw naval personnel was when the carriers came into Portsmouth Dockyard and they then flew their aircraft off and they landed at Gosport. And of course, quite a few of the pilots were naval officers, as were their observers. And also, a lot of the ground crew, as we would call them, the people who handled the aircraft, were ordinary sailors, able seamen. And they used to take great delight in polishing their aircraft, I remember, and complaining when they landed at Gosport, because their beautiful aircraft, which had been landing on clean decks, landed on the mud of Gosport, and there were no runways in those days, and the undercarriages used to get frightfully dirty, at which the Matlow complained bitterly.
No ill feeling between the services, then?
No. In my experience, the RAF and the Navy got on extremely well.
And then after that, you were off to Abiquil.
Yes, I boarded the troopship of great renown, HMT Somersetshire, at Southampton Docks, and we had on board the 1st Battalion of the Wilts, who were above us on the deck, because I must make the point that this was an army troopship, and therefore the RAF details went on the bottom deck. Life on board, I'm afraid, for the first 48 hours, I cannot recall, because in common with most of my colleagues, I was violently seasick. But eventually one came around and started taking an interest in one's surroundings. And the first thing that struck me, I think, was the amount of space that we had. I think there was something in the region of 900 personnel on board, and we had the foredeck, forward of the bridge, and a small piece down the side amidships. And we all sat around on the deck, most of the time playing housey-housey, the rest of the time looking over the side at nothing in particular, and waiting to hear one bell or two bells from the Lascar, who was at the top of the foremast in the crow's nest, as he used to beat out one stroke on the bell if there was a ship on the port bow, and two if there was one on the starboard bow, and then everyone would stand up and see if they could see it as well. In the evenings, down on the weather deck, a peculiar setup became very apparent. It was what was known as the Crown and Anchor School, and this was run by members of the ship's crew, and they all had crown and anchor boards, and they had small tins with a candle stuck in them to provide the light, because this was very illegal, and they had their scouts out to see if the officer of the day was on his rounds at all. And although these boards, there were about a half a dozen of them, would be surrounded by troops making their bets on what was called the King's Topi or the Old Muddock. If there was any sign of the officer of the day appearing, everything would disappear in about 5 seconds flat, and he would walk along and he would never have known that there was anything taking place at the time. The first port we called at was Gibraltar, where I was lucky enough to see the whole of the Mediterranean fleet and the home fleet, who had been on operations in the Atlantic in the harbour at the same time. The well-known and much-loved ships like HMS Ramillies, the Malaya, and ships of that type. And I remember now hearing the sunset being played by a marine bugler, and this echoing round the whole of the harbour, and all the ensigns coming down at the same time on the stern of these warships.
Marvellous picture of old empire.
Yes, very much so, and one which is with me very much to this day. We then went on to Malta, where we stayed for about 4 hours, and there, of course, the famous bumboatmen came alongside. This is a very interesting thing that used to happen in the old days. The Dizers used to come along, and the Maltese would throw up a rope with a little basket attached to it, and one, by placing money in the basket and yelling down to the man what you wanted, he would send up pieces of lace or fruit or anything you wanted. I saw one very interesting incident there. The rope of naturally sagged a bit, and the basket came handy to a porthole, and a hand came out, and the money which was in there was very rapidly taken away. After 10 days, we arrived at Alexandria, disembarked, were marched up to Alexandria Station, and then proceeded to Aboukir, which was in the depot for the whole of the Middle East Air Force. I was posted to A Squadron, which was the engine repair and MT repair squadron of the depot. And this was to be my home for the next 5.5 years. I was the storekeeper in the engine repair section, which carried out engine repairs, complete engine overhauls and repairs for the whole of the Royal Air Force in the Middle East, which then extended to Palestine, Amman, Transjordan, and down to the Sudan, and included Egypt also. The working routine in those days was, we started at 6 o'clock in the morning, we worked till 8, We had a half an hour for breakfast, and we then worked till 12:30, the rest of the day then being our own if we were not on guard. Guard duties came round about once in 10 days, and this meant being on parade at 6 o'clock in the evening and carrying out a guard duty until 6 o'clock on the following morning, and then on that day that you'd come off guard duty, you carried out a stick patrol in the afternoon around the factory in which the repairs were being carried out.
Did you have aircraft flying in there? Was there a fair amount of flying going on there?
Not in A Squadron. Such flying as was carried out at Aboukir was carried out in B Squadron, which was the squadron which carried out the aircraft repairs.